I want to begin by saying what an honor and pleasure it is to be here giving this lecture. This is, of course, a hallowed place for both of the specialties that I've been practicing for the last 30 years, and it's a great honor to be here. It's not coming up. Ah, there we go. Good. So these are two gentlemen that I've spent a lot of time with over the last three decades. And if anyone has glanced at my CV in the room, you'll notice that I've done a very good job of never talking about them at the same time. So I'm doing something for you that I have been very, very afraid of doing for the last three decades, and that is talking about Aristotle and Darwin in the same breath. But there's a good reason to do so, because there is a myth about a horrible incompatibility between Aristotle's thought and Darwinian thought, and I want to talk about that myth today. It wasn't something that Charles Darwin apparently observed. William Ogle, who did something that I did 100 or so years later, translated Aristotle's On the Parts of Animals for Oxford University Press, did an earlier version of that publication in 1882. And he sent a copy to Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin knew he was sick at that point in his life. He didn't know he was going to be dead in 3 months. He sat down and started to read the book after writing a very nondescript note to Ogle thanking him for the gift. But then he read Ogle's 35-page introduction. That got him interested, and he read all of Book 1 of the De Partibus Animalium and then started reading into Book 2 as far as he got when he got too sick to read any further. But at that point, he wrote a letter to the translator. "My dear Dr. Ogle, you must let me thank you for the pleasure which the introduction to the Aristotle book has given me. I have rarely read anything which has interested me more, though I have not read as yet more than a quarter of the book proper, that is, the actual Aristotle. From quotations which I had seen, I had a high notion of Aristotle's merits, but I had not the most remote notion what a wonderful man he was. Linnaeus and Cuvier have been my two gods, though in very different ways, but they were mere schoolboys to old Aristotle." A beautiful sentiment, but I think more than that. I'm going to mention a paper by my friend Alan Godhelf on a couple of slides from now, who's written a very wonderful paper called Darwin on Aristotle about this exchange of letters between Ogle and Darwin. And he has some very interesting things to say about why Linnaeus and Cuvier were Darwin's two gods, and why, after reading some Aristotle, he would think that they were schoolboys to Aristotle. Let's start by asking the question whether there is something very kindred in the spirits of Aristotle and Darwin. Here's a quote from On the Origin of Species, right after he's introduced the concept of natural selection in chapter 4. "Although natural selection," Darwin says, "can act only through and for the good of each being, yet characters and structures, which we are apt to consider as of very trifling importance, may be thus acted on." And notice that "for the good of each being" as the target of natural selection. And now look at this passage. "Nature makes nothing in vain, but always makes from among the possibilities that which is best for the being of each kind of animal." I suggest that you just do a little thought experiment for yourself and insert natural selection into nature there and see how Darwinian it actually sounds when you compare it with the previous passage. That's from Aristotle's De Incessu Animalium, on animal locomotion, if you like. So I think there's reason both in that correspondence and in the similar way in which they talk about nature and organisms to consider the question of whether there is a conflict. But there's an awful lot of people in the world that think there is. And there's a myth about the conflict between Aristotelianism and Darwinism that has penetrated most evolutionary biology textbooks at this point in time. So it's worth talking about. Here is the myth as I would summarize it. It starts with a discussion of Plato's theory of form. Knowledge, according to Plato, is of eternal and changeless types, of which the things that we see around us in this world are merely poor reflections, imperfect images. The myth continues that Aristotle's forms are really just Platonic forms embedded in natural things. They have all the same characteristics that Platonic forms have. All perfect members of a species have an identical essence or specific form, but they don't look like that perfect form because, of course, they have a whole bunch of other properties, but those are mere accidents, incidental to the nature of the organism. And the knowledge that we have of those forms is, in the form of a definition, a statement of the essence of that thing. And just like Platonic forms, the essence of the species is changeless and eternal. That allows for definitions to provide necessary and sufficient conditions for species membership, and therefore, this sounds like a view about essences that fits very well with modern ideas of essences in the post-Frege world that we live in. And finally, reproduction is just a way of maintaining that essence eternally. Well, every myth has an origin. And the origin of this myth actually is dual. One Austrian and one German. The philosophical origins go to Karl Popper. Sir Karl wrote this in the second volume of The Open Society and Its Enemies. Every discipline, so long as it used the Aristotelian method of definition, has remained arrested in a state of empty verbiage and barren scholasticism. Strong words, but Popper always had strong words. And the degree to which the various sciences have been able to make any progress depended on the degree to which they have been able to get rid of the essentialist method. The biological origins of the myth can be found in the great ornithologist and spokesman for the neo-Darwinian synthesis, Ernst Mayr. And I want to preface this, I'm going to say a critical word or two about Ernst Mayr. I became very close friends with him only after he was 80 years old, but we corresponded regularly for the last 20 years of his life because he lived to be well over 100. And he changed his views considerably about Aristotle. And in later writing, I'm going to show you something he wrote in the 60s here where Aristotle is just a pale version of Plato. In later writings, Ernst Mayr does modify that. But unfortunately, the myth began here and continued, regardless of him modifying his views in later writing. So here's what he said. Owing to its belief in essences, this philosophy, the philosophy he's criticizing, is also referred to as essentialism, its representatives as essentialists, and then he adds typologists. They were influenced by the idealist philosophy of Plato and the modifications of it by Aristotle. The concept of unchanging essences and of complete discontinuities between every eidos, type, and all others makes genuine evolutionary thinking well nigh impossible, he says. Okay, those are the origins. I'm going to show you two or three others, but I don't want to dwell on this. I just want to make it clear that there's a well-honed view out there. We could call David Hull's version a hybrid cross because as a philosopher of biologists who spent a great deal of his life hanging out with biologists, the version that you get from him sounds like a blend of Popper and Marr, in fact. So you'll see the word Aristotelian definition and typologists there in his paper, The Effects of Essentialism on Taxonomy, 2,000 Years of Stasis. Strong words again. And somebody who never minced his words, Michael Gieselin, says pretty much the same thing. These essences retain their timeless and changeless character. Individual men might change, but for the class man to change would not even have made any sense. Species could not originate. And one last version. Eliot Sober has a version that takes a slightly different slant and talks about, it takes into account, as I'm going to really, stress today, that Aristotle talks an awful lot about variation in his biology, so that all this talk about him ignoring it and only paying attention to the essence and the timeless type doesn't seem to work very well. But on Sober's view, it turns out that the variation is just deviation on Aristotle's view, and that it's therefore something that you should ignore in trying to get at the essence of things. All right, the myth has had critics in recent years, and I'll just give you a few examples. But of these people, the only one that's actually discussed the way in which the myth is taken back to Aristotle is John Wilkins. And the discussion is fairly superficial, I would say. It doesn't go into the details of Aristotle's biological work at all. And this is important. Both Popper and Ernst Mayr actually do say that Plato is the origins of the view that they're criticizing. Why does Aristotle get into the picture? Because everybody knows that Aristotle is the founder of the science of biology. And so for this to become a problem for the biological sciences, it has to become a problem for Aristotle the biologist, because he's the one that everybody's going to be commenting on in the Renaissance, and all of the biology in the 16th and 17th century is going to be relying on Aristotle, and frankly, the biology of Linnaeus and Cuvier is going to be relying on Aristotle. So they're trying to make a connection between the fight that Darwin was having with people in the 18th and 19th century, with Aristotle, by sort of relying on the idea that Aristotle had a lasting influence in biology on the people that Darwin is fighting with. And I'm going to talk about that at the end of the lecture today, how accurate that is as a piece of history. I think it's not very accurate. All right, so I'm going to respond to this myth in two steps, and I'll have a little coda at the end as well. We'll come back and talk about the two gentlemen. But I'm going to spend a lot of time providing an account of Aristotle's essentialism embedded in his actual biological work and try to get you to see how that actually works in practice. It's not an easy thing to do in a brief lecture, but I'll give it a shot. What I hope you'll see is that it has absolutely nothing to do with the myth that I've just recounted. And the second step will be to actually take a look at what Darwin himself thought he was up against. He's got a problem, all right. He's got a problem with people who want to essentially rule out the possibility of species changing, essentially by definition. But the problem he's having is not a problem that Aristotle had anything to do with, and that's what I want to argue. And if I have some time, I will talk about couple of things that are going on in contemporary evolutionary biology that might have some interesting ways of seeing how Aristotle might be having a positive effect on the biological sciences today. Okay, so I want to talk about Aristotle's biological science as instituting a kind of three-step program. Three-step program is needed because there was absolutely nothing that could even remotely count as biological science before Aristotle. There was writing in medicine by a group of doctors whose names mostly we don't know, but who are known today as Hippocratics, because they studied, at least some of them, at a school founded by Hippocrates. But they were focused entirely on human beings and the concept of a general theoretical science of the whole living world simply wasn't on their purview. Some of the pre-Socratics that we have fragments of also mention animals, but they're doing a very general cosmogony or cosmology where animals play occasional roles, getting mentioned here and there. But to actually have the self-conscious idea that there could be a theoretical science of life, this was Aristotle's basic gift to the world, and he really got science going. But that means you have to figure out, how do you start a science when there's nothing there? I mean, we don't have to worry about that. At least mostly we don't. But Aristotle did. This was a big problem. And I think he was as successful as he was because he'd already done a lot of work in what we would today refer to as the philosophy of science. That is, he had done a lot of work thinking about what it takes to actually get scientific knowledge about something and how you go about that. And he thought very deep and hard about that in general, and I think it paid off when he had to actually essentially invent a science. So the first step in this three-step program is what I'll call identifying entry-level kinds. These are kinds that Aristotle thinks you can get a grasp on and a hold on before you actually have any kind of deep understanding of the animal. So here's what he says about that. In those cases where people refer to kinds in a clearly defined manner and where kinds have a single common nature and forms in them not too distinct from each other, we should refer to these animals in common as a single kind, as we do with birds and fish. And Aristotle comments a number of times that he thinks the general public, hoi polloi, had already figured out how to do this with birds and fish, but he's going to go much, much further, as we're going to see. And we should do the same, he says, with any other currently unnamed group that embrace, as kinds do, many forms within it. So if there are any others that have the same basic structure, and what is the structure? Well, he's told us. There's a normative account of kind identification hidden in this comment of his. First of all, there has to be a common nature that you're going after. Secondly, there has to be many forms not too different from one another. And the kind may not be named, so you may not be able to rely on the common language in order to help you identify these things. This is, I think, Aristotle's claim that you can actually get a grip on things that have a common nature, that underlies their similarities, before you actually know what that common nature is. How are you going to do that? This is, of course, the problem that Plato gave us in his Meno. And Aristotle is trying to answer it. Is there a way that you can actually get preliminary grip on something before you actually know what that thing is? I should mention that what I'm translating here as form is sometimes translated species. Eidos is the word. It's the same word, however, that Aristotle uses when he talks about organisms like us being made of matter and form. And I think it's a good idea to translate it with the same word. And as you'll see, you can translate it with form and very easily talk about forms of animals. So it's not really too difficult to avoid that problematic translation. Okay, so how do we go about doing this? Well, Aristotle goes on in the same chapter to talk about how you go about doing it. It's by finding groups where the figures of the parts and of the whole body bear a likeness that the kinds have been demarcated. For example, members of the kind bird are related in this way to one another, as are members of the kind fish. And now he mentions two more. Also, the soft-bodied animals, I'm just translating the Greek more or less literally there, but he's referring to the group that we call cephalopods, and I've highlighted that because we're going to talk about them for a while. And the hard-shelled animals, and by that he means the shelled mollusks. So he's talking about what we would today call the two kinds of mollusks. For their parts are not merely analogous to one another, as bone in mankind is analogous to fish spine in fish, but rather their parts are of the same kind and differ only by being larger or smaller, softer or harder, smoother or rougher, and so on. And speaking generally, he says, they vary by the more and the less. They vary continuously, if you like. So what he's saying here is that the groups that he's talking about, these what I'm calling entry-level kinds, will have many forms of animals within them, and every one of those animals will have similar characteristics that vary from one form to the other by continuous variation. Doesn't sound like the essentialist that we were hearing about. Now, here are the kinds he eventually identifies, and I'll just lay them next to the groups that we would use in popular parlance today for the same groups. He divides his groups into blooded and bloodless. The bloodless are the cetacea, porpoises, dolphins, whales, and so on. A group he calls four-legged live-bearing animals. We would call them mammals, except human beings are mammals, and they obviously aren't four-legged. Four-legged egg-laying animals, that includes our reptiles and amphibians, and birds and fish. And then there's the bloodless, which are the soft-shelled, we would call them crustaceans, the hard-shelled, soft-bodied, and the insects. So here are the modern equivalents. Whoop. Go back so you can see that for a second. So his blooded maps on pretty much to our vertebrates. His bloodless maps on pretty well to our invertebrates. What you need to remember, though, is when you get below this level of generality, Aristotle doesn't have a taxonomic project at all. He's not going to do what Linnaeus does. He's not going to give you all kinds of layers of taxonomic specificity between these very large groups and the kinds of animals that we would call species, because that's just not what he's interested in. And so there's all kinds of animals he talks about in his biology that don't fit in to this categorization at all. And he tells you that. He says, these ones don't belong in the kinds. Doesn't matter. He's not trying to do what Linnaeus was trying to do. All right, so let's have some examples. The cephalopods, he says, are one of these kinds. So take a look at what we've got here. And he knows about something that looks like every one of these, though he may not know about these particular ones. That one's the giant squid, which very rarely gets its picture taken, but it did a few times. Okay, just let that sink in for a minute. Think about that more and less variation stuff. All right. Now, here's his introduction to the discussion of the cephalopods in the Historia Animalium. And bear with me, I'm going to read all the way through this because it's going to serve as the background for a good bit of the talk. Among all the animals called soft bodies, these are the external parts. And he's only talking about the external parts here. The so-called feet, the tentacles, the head, continuous with the feet, the sac, containing the internal organs, which some mistakenly call the head, the fin, which encircles the sac, and in all the soft-bodied, the head turns out to be between the feet and the belly, a very odd thing for most people to get their grip on. Moreover, all have 8 feet, and all have 2 rows of suckers, except for one kind of octopus. The cuttlefish and the large and small calamari have a distinctive feature, 2 long tentacles. Remember that picture with the 2 tentacles hanging out beside? The ends of which are rough with 2 rows of suckers by which they capture food and convey it to their mouth and fasten themselves to a rock when it storms like an anchor. All right. I'm going to come back to those comments in just a few minutes, but what we're really going to be talking about is those guys as an example of Aristotle trying to get a handle on what something is, essentially, and provide a causal explanation for its features. A brief preliminary, there really isn't a word in Aristotle's Greek that I think essence is a good translation of, quite frankly. The literal translations of the words that often get translated, essence, would be beingness, the what it is. Aristotle's philosophy is often viewed as organized around questions, and he'll often refer to items of knowledge by just nominalizing the question that they answer. So the what is it is what you identify when you answer the question, what is it? The being what it is the answer to the question, what's the being of that thing? And so on and so forth. In Aristotle's view, what's and why questions are very, very closely related. And in addition, his 4 causes have the same kind of structure that I've just been mentioning. The 4 causes are 4 distinct facts, if you like, that answer 4 distinct kinds of questions. For him, a scientific definition is a disguised causal explanation. And I'm going to give you, first of all, the theory behind that, which is a passage in the Posterior Analytics. And here's what he says, and he's using thunder as a kind of made-up example, just to get the point across. There's a difference between saying why it thunders and what thunder is. In the former case, you will answer in this way, because the fire in the clouds was quenched, and there's a because there. But to answer what is thunder, you will say a noise of fire being quenched in the clouds. So the same account is given in a different way. In the one case, it's a continuous demonstration or explanation. In the other, it's a definition. So that's the relationship in theory between a definition of something and a causal explanation. At the end of his chapter discussing the heart in On the Parts of Animals, and he does this at the end of many of the discussions in the parts of animals, he concludes by reminding you of the close relationship between causal explanation and definition. He concludes with the following words. regarding the heart then, what sort of thing it is, and what it's for the sake of, that's Aristotle's final cause, and the cause owing to which it is present in those animals that have it, let so much be said. In other words, what he says is, in the account of the heart that I've just given you, I've given you both an account of what the heart is, and I've also told you why the heart belongs to the animals that it belongs to, why they have a heart. So he's given you both a causal explanation and an account of what the heart is. Very closely related. Now, recall that passage from the discussion of the cephalopods in the Historia Animalia, where he says all octopuses have two rows of suckers except for one kind of octopus. Here's what he says in the De Partibus Animalium about that. While the other octopuses have two rows of suckers, one kind has a single row. This is because of the length and thinness of their nature. For it's necessary that the narrow tentacle have a single row of suckers. It's not then because it's best that they have this feature, but because it's necessary, owing to the distinctive account of their being. So what he's saying is that owing to what they essentially are, namely, they have this very narrow tentacle, they, of necessity, can only have one row of suckers. So you get an explanation out of that by reference to the specific nature of this particular kind of animal. An account of its essence gives you a causal explanation, if you like. Lest you think Aristotle is making all this up, I thought I would show you something from a German website. Fortunately, it has English for me. The lesser octopus can be distinguished from the common octopus by its tentacles, only provided with a single row of suckers, while the common octopus has two rows of suckers on each arm, and this is the picture they provide in case you think they're making it up. So Aristotle knew about this difference. Moreover, he provided an explanation of it, and moreover, that explanation takes you right back to the specific essential nature of this particular kind of octopus and how he differs from the other octopuses. So that's a German website devoted to Erstaugliche über Weichtier. How'd I do? Pretty bad. That's why you don't want me speaking in German. All right, now the interesting thing about that explanation is often one of the things you hear about Aristotle is he always gives teleological explanations for everything. Every explanation Aristotle gives is telling you what it's for, what its purpose is. Well, you'll notice that explanation about the single row of suckers, he says it's not because it's good that they have a single row. It'd be better if they had two, but they can't. Tentacles too narrow. But I thought you should also have an example of a functional explanation from Aristotle, because that's what he's most famous for. So you'll recall that reference to the squid and the calamaries having those two very long tentacles in addition to the eight legs that all the other creatures of this kind have. So here's what he says in his explanation for that feature. They have two long tentacles by which they moor themselves and by which they hunt down prey from afar and bring it to themselves. The octopuses, on the other hand, don't have these because their feet are useful for these activities. Octopuses can actually use their own legs for that purpose. Aristotle's theory is these guys don't have appropriate legs for capturing prey, so they've been given two other instruments for doing that. And here's what a modern textbook says about exactly the same thing. Their preferred diet is crabs and fish, and when it's close enough, it opens apart its eight arms and outshoot two deceptively long feeding tentacles. On the end of each is a pad covered in suckers that grasp hold of the prey. Now, I noticed when I've looked at a number of different texts on this subject, they don't mention this idea about them using it to grab on during storms to hold themselves down. And I'm wondering where Aristotle got that idea. Aristotle's been proven right many, many times after people for hundreds of years said that he made something up, so I wouldn't doubt that he actually knows something we don't know in this case. Finally, this is basically, I'm just throwing this in because of Eliot Sober's remark about all variation being deviance and therefore Aristotle ignores it. This is a passage from his Generation of Animals where he's talking about the inheritance of family resemblances. Why it is that we tend to look like our parents and not just like another member of the species, as you might think an essentialist would suppose we should. I don't know how you would look like a member of the species without looking like a particular member of the species, but there you go. So here's what he says. In relation to generation, the distinction, the distinctive and particular features are always stronger. For Coriscus is both a man and an animal, but the man is nearer to what is distinctive than the animal. And both the particular and the kind generate, but more so the particular, for this is the being. And what is coming to be is, while a certain sort of animal, also this animal here. And this is the being. Wherefore, the motions present in the seeds are from all such powers, potentially even from the ancestors, but more from those closer to one of the particulars. And by particular, I mean Coriscus and Socrates. So this is a passage that's in a long discussion, so I can't give you all the details, but I take it what he's saying is that the specific and generic characters of any animal are general characters that are passed on along with the dominant movements representing the features of the individual parents. So to give you an example that would fit with what he's talking about, Socrates's peculiar nose will of necessity be a human nose, and will of necessity be an animal nose. You can't have a particular kind of nose that isn't also, representative of some species or genus or other. But it's the stress on the particularity as being the being that I want you to notice here. All right, so summing up this part of the talk, Aristotle is, as far as I can tell from all of my study of him, and I'm trying to give you an example of what I'm talking about in this lecture, is not what these guys are talking about when they talk about a typological essentialist. He is, in contemporary parlance, what might be called an explanatory essentialist. That is, Aristotle does think it's very important to penetrate to the nature of the kind of organism you're studying in order to explain everything else about it. That's where the explanations come from. Biological research progresses, as I've tried to show you, through these three stages where you first grasp at a very general level these entry-level kinds. And these are identified just by being sort of loci of correlated parts, activities, and habits. That's what you saw in that Historia Animalium passage where Aristotle listed all of the external parts that all of the cephalopods have in common. Then you do a study of the continuous more and less, as he calls it, variation in those common features that are shared by, say, all the cephalopods. So Aristotle will tell you all those general features that they all have. Then he'll tell you something that only the octopuses have. And then he'll tell you something specific to a particular kind of octopus that distinguishes it from all the others. But the end game for Aristotle, what he's really after, is causal explanation. And so in the end, what he wants to be able to do is explain that variation to you. He wants to be able to give you an explanation of why some of the cephalopods have those two very long tentacles. He wants to be able to give you an explanation for why it is that only one kind of octopus has a single row of suckers where all the others have two. That's what he's out to explain. And I tried to give you two examples, one of which the essential feature that does the explaining is a structural feature, the width of the tentacle, and the other is a functional feature, the good that it serves to have those tentacles, those long, long tentacles. Okay, so basically what I'm saying is Aristotle was not the source of what these mythologers are talking about when they talk about Darwin being up against some kind of essentialism. And I want to say a little bit now about what he is up against. So this is a passage from Charles Lyell, beginning of the second volume of his Principles of Geology. It's very interesting. If you haven't read that second volume of Lyell's Principles of Geology, you should look at it sometime if you have already read On the Origin of Species, because what you will see is almost a blueprint for On the Origin of Species. Because this volume of the Principles of Geology is about basically what we can learn about the history of life on Earth by studying the fossil record and contemporary distribution of animals. The two things that Aristotle thought were the best evolution, best evidence for evolutionary change. But Lyell, of course, is not an evolutionist, and he's in these chapters criticizing Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, Darwin's evolutionary predecessor. And here's what he says. The majority of naturalists agree with Linnaeus that all individuals propagated from one stock have certain distinguishing characteristics in common which will never vary and which have remained the same since the creation of each species. Now, a reviewer of On the Origin of Species picks up on this very idea of what goes into the definition of a species. His name is William Hopkins, and he writes, every natural species must, by definition, have a separate and independent origin, so that all theories which assert the derivation of all classes of animals from one origin do, in fact, deny the existence of natural species at all. Now, you see what's been done here. The definition of species is made to include derived from a common origin or a common ancestor. So by definition, if you can trace two animals back to a common ancestor, it doesn't matter how different they are, it's going to turn out that they're the same species. And he says if you deny that, you're denying the whole nature of species itself. Well, Darwin knows he's up against this. This basically makes evolution impossible. By definition, not by scientific research. So here's what he says in chapter 2. And this is what these guys are talking about when they criticize Darwin. So I want to look at this language carefully. From these remarks, it will be seen that I look at the term species as one arbitrarily given for the sake of convenience to a set of individuals closely resembling each other, and that it does not essentially differ from the term variety, which is given to less distinct and more fluctuating forms. The term variety, again in comparison with mere individual differences, is also applied arbitrarily and for mere convenience. So is Darwin denying the existence of species here? That's the way a lot of people read him. And if that's the case, then you have to ask yourself the question, what's On the Origin of Species about? And in fact, there was another reviewer, an American reviewer, Louis Agassiz, well, a Swiss reviewer who lived in the United States, who actually said that. He said, well, given what Darwin said, he seems to be denying the reality of species, so I wonder why he called his book On the Origin of Species. That seems very strange. In the concluding chapter of On the Origin of Species, however, Darwin says some slightly different things that we need to pay careful attention to. When the views entertained in this volume, he says, on the origin of species are generally admitted, systematists will be able to pursue their labors as they do at present, but they will not be incessantly haunted by the shadowy doubt whether this or that form be in essence a a species. They will only have to decide whether any form be sufficiently constant and distinct from other forms to be capable of definition, and if definable, whether the differences be sufficiently important to deserve a specific name. And that has a consequence for how we have to study the living world. We shall be led to weigh more carefully and to value higher the actual amount of difference between two forms. Now, I want you to notice that what he's saying there is that going after a definition of something at the species level is both appropriate and proper and difficult and will require attending to the differences between forms more carefully than we have before. When you put that together with the other passages, what you realize is the other passages are about something different. They're about defining the species category. They're not about defining cephalopod or octopus. They're about saying what in essence is a species. It's about the category, not about defining and discovering the essence of particular kinds of animals. So when you read passages like this, it's very interesting that every time he uses the phrase, the term species. And you'll notice it's not the essence of a species he's referring to here, it's the essence of the term species that he's referring to. But then the question is, why does he think it's a vain search? Well, I don't know how many people in the audience are practicing biologists, but if there are any out there, you will know that there are almost as many different kinds of different definitions of species today as there are people practicing systematics. It's absolutely bizarre. I think Darwin was trying to warn them to stop doing it. Here is a passage where I think he really gets at the nub of things. This is from something that he never published. It was the big species book he was working on when Alfred Russel Wallace sent him his paper with very similar evolutionary ideas to Darwin's. And Darwin's friends urged him, publish a short book now, because at the rate you're going on that big species book, it's not going to be out for 10 years, and everybody's going to be saying Wallace came up with the idea. So he dropped the big species book. But we happen to have it. We have the manuscript. Darwin saved every scrap of paper he ever wrote on, as far as I can tell. And a man named Stopher in the 70s actually published the manuscript of the big species book as far as Darwin had got. And here's a passage in this section of that book on species and species definitions. How various are the ideas that enter into the mind of naturalists when speaking of species. With some resemblance is the reigning idea, descent goes for little. With others, descent is the infallible criterion. With others, resemblance goes for almost nothing, and creation is everything. With others, sterility in crossed forms is an unfailing test of species, whilst with others, it's regarded as no value. At the end of this chapter, it will be seen that according to the views which we've discussed in this volume, it's no wonder that there should be difficulty in defining the difference between species and variety, there being no essential, only an arbitrary difference. Now, when you actually look at Darwin's practice here, what he actually does is lay out all the criteria that people use as practicing naturalists to distinguish between varieties, try to decide, is this a variety, are these two things varieties of one species, or are they actually different enough that they should count as different species? And what he does is then say, you know, every one of these has problems. And when you look at the way practicing naturalists operate, they tend to choose the one that works best in the little domain that they're working in. This is the source of his skepticism about trying to come up with an infallible criterion for distinguishing variety from species. The real issue, obviously, is leaving room so that varieties can be converted to good and true species by means of natural selection. But Darwin uses that language all the time, converting varieties into good and true species. So that's what he needs. He needs a theory where different species must be able to be originated by a process of natural selection. These varieties have to be able to be varying in many different respects so that natural selection can keep acting on them over a long period of time, and eventually they'll diverge sufficiently that we'll be happy by one or another or maybe many criteria to call them species. So if you look back at those quotes I gave you earlier with that in mind, especially that one about systematists being able to work the way they have in the past, finding those constant and distinct variations that will count for species rank. So he's basically saying, finding the essence of the species category is a vain project. But defining a form and determining whether it deserves to be ranked at the level of species is both something that biologists ought to be concerned with, and it's also a difficult task. So I want to close with some common ground between our two men. Both of them are deeply interested in explaining the subtle differences between different forms within kinds. Both of them think that in explaining those differences, you'll have to appeal to something more fundamental about the organism. You'll have to appeal to the value of the differences for the organism in question. Or maybe you'll have to appeal to something about that organism that forces it to have that kind of difference. You'll need to think about whether you can resolve those differences into continuous variations or not. And something that people really don't pay enough attention to in Aristotle is his discussion about forms within kinds varying by more and less, varying by continuous variation. That's very hard to make compatible with any of this discussion of Aristotle's essentialism that you see in the contemporary literature. Neither of them consider that taxonomic rankings are written into nature by God. And so the kind of project that Linnaeus is carrying out is not something that Aristotle was responsible for, and it's something that Darwin is very much trying to overcome, because what he wants to say is that taxonomic system that Linnaeus has laid out for us is very hard to cut at the joints, very, very hard to cut at the joints. But I've got a way of understanding it. It's genealogy. It's all genealogy. Both of them also think that there's an explanatory project behind any classificatory project. Classification is not an end in itself. You don't learn about God's mind by classifying. Classification has to play into some kind of explanatory project. And both Aristotle and Darwin are on the same page on that. Now, what I do want to close by saying is that there was a denouement to the relationship between Darwin and William Ogle, the translator of the Parts of Animals that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. William Ogle was very moved by the letter he got from Darwin. And he wrote back to Darwin and said to Darwin, I'm so happy that you enjoyed what you were reading, and I was especially happy to contribute a third person to your gods and complete the Trinity. Now, I've worked my whole life on these two people. I've always sensed a personal kind of affinity between them. They seem like the same kind of person. They seem to have the same kind of feel for the study of nature. They seem to have similar projects in many ways, notwithstanding the huge differences in time and context. What really moves me, however, is to realize that almost the last thing that Charles Darwin was reading before he died, and it may indeed been the last book he was actually reading before he died, because he stopped partway through it, was Aristotle's On the Parts of Animals. And I just have this wonderful feeling thinking that there's a smile on Darwin's face in all the pain at the end of his life because he's got the parts of animals open in front of him. Isn't that a nice thought? Thank you very much.